Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is the Lois J. Wetzel Show, and I'm your host and executive producer, Lois Wetzel, coming to you live this morning from 9 a.m. Houston, Texas, Central Time. I want to remind you to register for Blog Talk Radio. It's free, and if you do that, you can rate my show, mark it as a favorite, and let people know that you were here and listening to my show. You can get reminders of upcoming shows. It's all free. My call-in number is 347-945-5309. You can call using the telephone or Skype. You can listen on your phone or your computer. If you're calling in and you want to ask a question, just hit the number 1 and I'll know that you would like to ask a question. I also want to remind you that I offer a free email newsletter about metaphysics, spirituality, the coming changes, all the kinds of things we talk about here on this show. I've been sending this newsletter out for about 12 years, and to sign up for that, you would go to my website, hotpinklotus.com. I do not share email addresses with anyone because your privacy is important.
Good morning. Today I have the honor of speaking with Dr. Ingrid Naaman, world-class herbologist who has more blogs and websites for educational purposes than you can imagine. Among them is kitchendoctor.com, also Sacred Medicine at sacred-medicine.org, and most recently zerorads.com. She will talk with us today about which herbs can be used to help the body fight radiation exposure in the aftermath of the tsunami in Japan and the failure of the nuclear power plants. There's an above-average interest in herbs for this purpose. So without any further ado, I'm going to dial her on the phone.
Lois.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm glad that worked.
Is it clear?
Yes, it's quite clear, actually, and we're on the air. I'm so happy to have you here. I've been following your blogs and your newsletters for such a long time and first got interested about, I don't know, 15 or maybe more years ago about the cancer salves and have been just absolutely fascinated with your work and just totally impressed with your devotion to teaching, which is something I admire very much, is people who are devoted to teaching, probably because I think it's so important. I also want you to know that I sent a link to your Japanese version of Zerorads to some friends in Japan, and they're very excited. I sent it yesterday. So they're forwarding it to a lot of their friends. So you want to talk to us about which herbs people can use to mitigate the effects of radiation exposure?
Well, that's kind of jumping in feet first, isn't it?
Where do you want to start?
I had a dream last night. Can I tell you my dream?
And
that
was please.
To try to
I love
explain
that.
What the real problem with radiation is.
Yeah.
And that was, if you're building a house mm-hmm. and you set a foundation and you put in some rebar and cement and then you put up your posts and you start nailing things together. Now, suppose some mason comes over and says, I'm going to have some fun with this builder. I'm going to remove some nails here and there, and then we'll see what happens. And I'm going to start with the window, and I'm going to take out all the nails that are holding the window in place.
Ingrid, we're having some problems with the connectivity with the phone. Your voice is kind of wavering. Are you on a portable phone, maybe?
I feel better time on the VOP. I know you don't trust it, but it actually...
Yeah, it's really giving bad sound quality. Because your voice is like coming through like brrr, like that. Is there another possibility?
Can mm-hmm. you call me on a different line?
I sure can.
Is this on the air where everybody can hear my
number?
Yeah,
it is on the air.
Yeah,
unfortunately. You want to email me that number?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, email it to me, and then we'll just, I'll dial you from that number. Okay. Boy, Mercury is really playing with us today. Anyway, what we're going to talk about is herbs and how radiation affects the body and how the herbs can counter that effect. Just as soon as we can get these telephone snafus worked out. You know, Mercury affects travel. It also affects communications and computers and things like that. So, this is what's going on today. Okay, let's see if I'm seeing a new caller. I just don't know if that's Ingrid or not. Yeah, here
Hello.
We go. Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Ingrid.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you surprised me. You called by a number I didn't recognize. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
you were building
building this house. Pardon?
You were building a house.
Yeah, we were building this house, and then this little mischievous person came and started removing nails. And we were expecting the house to stand up despite all this missing normal building material. And that's what happens with radiation. Essentially, you've got every cell in the body very neatly connected the way it's supposed to be connected, and then the radiation comes in and it breaks up these connections. And it does that because it itself is unstable and it's electron hungry. And so really what you're trying to do when you're exposed to a risk like that is provide herbs and food that are so electron rich that they can spare these extra electrons and not be damaged in the process of giving up electrons. And that's what an antioxidant is. An antioxidant somehow is able to give away enough electrons that it will stabilize an unstable situation, and at the same time it's no worse for having done that. And once you understand radiation in that way, you are much less afraid of it, which is not to say that you could jump in feet first in the coolants in the reactors and expect to live through it. There were some people in Chernobyl who did that. Two men were trying to open a valve and manually, because all the equipment wasn't working properly. And so they went swimming in this. And you know that's not how you survive nuclear radiation. But if one just has a casual exposure to it, not an intense exposure, but what most of us are going to have some kind of casual exposure. And so what we need is a lot of foods that are very, very high in two particular properties. One is antioxidants and the other is flavonoids. And they probably go hand in hand sometimes, not always, but sometimes. And I'm not saying that if people have multiple risk factors that this is going to be enough. But let's say someone is smoking, and they think, well, I'm not going to stop smoking just because there's some problem in Fukushima. Well, probably if they ever considered that they should stop smoking, now is a really good time. And if they have some other risk factors, let's say that they work in chemical plants or offices where they have a lot of copy machines or fumants like paint stores or dry cleaning places, this is so insulting to the body that they really need to consider whether they can tolerate both the radiation and their normal way of making a living. They might not work together very well at this point. But for the majority of people who are reasonably healthy, who eat decent food, if they just enrich their diet, I'm pretty convinced by the research I've done that they're going to be all right. Which is not saying we don't have a disaster. We have a disaster. We have an environmental disaster. The radiation is going to get into the food chain. It already is in some places. I don't know how the strontium is appearing in Moscow. It's quite heavy. So it's got
what is appearing? What is it that's appearing in Moscow?
Strontium.
Oh.
And it's... we expected the lighter radioactive materials like iodine and cesium to be carried by the winds, but personally I expected most of the strontium and uranium to stay put right near the reactor site itself. Because they're so heavy that the amount of explosive force must push them up very high. And so we're not being told exactly how much hydrogen explosive material there was. But nobody can really predict what's going to travel, how or how long it's going to take to precipitate. What we're learning as we're all becoming more aware of radiation is that some of the fallout from the nuclear testing in Nevada has not precipitated yet.
It's suspended.
Yeah, so this is a very long-term situation, and everybody who is environmentally conscious needs to make a commitment to planting garden and farm plants that will remediate this, bind the radioactive substances in the soil. And there are certain microorganisms that will support this. And the interesting thing is that they're all dark in color. They have an enormously high melanin content just to be able to do this work. So they're getting this radioprotective property from the melanin. So the first sign of life in Chernobyl after that accident, it was a kind of slimy fungus inside the reactor itself, a very awful-looking black fungus. And I think we're none of us really as much up to speed on radiation as we need to be. What I'm learning, this might appeal to you in your shamanic capacity, is that all uranium apparently came from supernovas.
Came from
and
what?
So supernovas.
Oh, okay.
So what has happened is that in the process of creating the Earth, this material from the supernovas was apparently used to build the Earth, and most of it concentrated in the core of the Earth. But initially, the Earth was too radioactive to support life. And then various forms of bacteria and fungi began to break down some of this radioactivity, bind it in a way that allowed for the development of a wider variety of life forms. And so this has been going on for about 4.5 billion years, something like that, and here we are today, making the Earth less habitable than nature wanted it to be. We're going the opposite direction. We're causing more radioactivity instead of letting it reduce naturally, as it would, because the radioactivity is part of the decay. So if you think of some fruit on your kitchen counter that's going bad on you, it starts to smell. And that odor is its radiation, so to speak. So the uranium, when it's breaking down, is releasing, it's releasing a particulate that makes it more stable. Once it releases this alpha particle, then it becomes something else, which is slightly more stable than the uranium, which it becomes thorium. But it's all a process of decay, but we're talking about some substances now that have a decay of millions, billions of years. Not all of it. Radioactive iodine is just over 7-8 days, something like that. So what I've been, I expected that the Japanese would have had this situation under control by now, and that from the moment there was no further release into the environment, we wouldn't have to worry about iodine after about a month. I guess I worded that a little bit strangely. But because it has such a short half-life, our thyroid risk would be gone a month after Fukushima's stopped releasing more radiation into the environment.
Mm-hmm.
The initial preparation that people were doing, and many are still doing, is to increase their iodine intake, which essentially says, I have so much iodine in my body, I don't need any more, so I'm not going to absorb this radioactive iodine. And there are no more storage depots in the body. It's a theory, and I don't think the theory is perfect in the event that someone were to inhale or ingest it. So the issue is still that some people are going to excrete it or metabolize it or somehow deal with it much more efficiently than others. And that's what everyone really needs to think about now, because we're going to be living with this challenge for at least a century. This is an irrevocable challenge now. I spent a lot of time in Europe, and people are still talking about Chernobyl. It was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And there are farms in England that cannot sell any of their produce and will not be able to sell their produce for at least another 75 years simply because of an accident that took place thousands of miles away.
But they just happen to be in the plume.
That's exactly right. But
the wind path.
Fukushima is so much greater than from Chernobyl.
Yeah. So have they planted things in those farms, that those dark leafy things that you were talking about, that will lock that stuff in the soil? Or
a lot of those experiments have been done in the area immediately surrounding Chernobyl. And Germany, of course, which is very proactive on this subject, and we don't know a fraction as much as we need to. There's some very large corporations involved, DuPont, for example, that's using sunflower. They're actually floating sunflower plants onto radioactive bodies of water, and within 24 hours, the roots of the sunflower can absorb enough radiation to purify the water. But then the roots and the stalk of the sunflower have to be disposed of as hazardous waste.
Yeah.
And so naturally, because of the power of the nuclear industry and so on, there are people trying to think, well, how can we harvest the uranium that we want to use in our next reactor, right?
Mm-hmm.
We will never learn. We're very slow.
Well, I think we'll learn. I think it takes incidents like this, but I hold the belief and the hope that we will learn. And so what do we do now in terms of creating that safe space for ourselves and our families personally, in terms of what should we be ingesting right now to fill in those gaps?
you're thinking of, where the nails are removed.
Yeah. Interestingly, beets are very high on the list. That can sort of make this a little simpler. When I was first getting into health and nutrition, I read something that it was suspected that whatever it was that made beets red in color was a free radical scavenger, a hydroxyl free radical scavenger. And hydroxyl free radicals are pretty serious. And it's now becoming clear that almost all plants that have that reddish color or purplish color are way superior in terms of their ability to scavenge the free radicals. So, for example, in working with my Japanese colleague and translator, Dr. Yuri Hiranuma, we're trying to urge Japanese people to eat black rice instead of white rice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually been studied to show that it is more radioprotective.
Isn't that black rice kind of purplish?
Yeah. And the same with, like, black turtle beans or black beans.
Uh-huh.
Or purple potatoes. All of them have more flavonoids and more free radical scavenging ability. So there's simple dietary changes that are going to be supportive of getting through this with fewer consequences. What also happens besides free radicals is that the free radicals are themselves a source of instability in our own personal chemistry. And because they are like the radioactive materials in that they are unstable and want to therefore pirate some electrons from somewhere, involuntary donors in some cases, it sets off a chain reaction of deterioration of our tissue structure. And so in my involvement, you mentioned that when you were first introducing me on cancer, there are countless herbs that help to repair tissue damage, that help to repair even damaged DNA. And one of the most interesting ones is burdock. And when I was doing the research for my cancer book and analyzing all the formulas going back literally 2,500 years, but more specifically starting with Hildegard of Bingen, burdock was the one herb that appeared in every major successful formula. Otherwise, every formula was quite different. And both the Japanese and Hungarians have researched it really well. And the Japanese call it the B factor. They gave it that name as a sort of respect for the power of this herb to reverse mutations in cells.
Wow.
And burdock is perfectly edible. I have it growing in my yard. I harvested some last year and made some delicious, I don't know what you call it, cutlets. They're sort of like a potato pancake, except that they're made with burdock instead. Last night I made a stir fry, and another very interesting herb that I'm going to be writing about soon on zerorads.com is Mista. It's Cypress rotundus is the botanical name. And this was regarded as a food for people going through famine, like in Africa.
Wow, what's the name of that one again? What's the common name and the Latin name?
Well, the Sanskrit name is Mista. And it's Cypress rotundus. And it's a weed, an invasive weed, like so many things that we don't like. Nature has an instinct to balance itself. So when we're using all these harsh chemicals in our gardening or farming, we're destroying the soil. We're burning all the organisms in the soil that would stabilize the soil. And so you have plants that volunteer to fix it. And it's very interesting if you're into permaculture that the weeds disappear on their own once they've done their work. You can be out there weeding on your hands and knees year after year after year, but once you change your gardening practices and stop using the chemicals, then the weeds will say, okay, now I've finished my work. Here I'm going to let something else grow. And when I first got into this, I was a city person. I wasn't observant of these things. And I looked at the dandelions in my yard, and my neighbors sent me, we're in a subdivision where we have rules, and they said that these fuzzy-looking white things in my yard weren't acceptable. And I said, oh, gosh, but I'm starting to love them now that I understand them. And after getting that letter from the Homeowners Association, I went on a little drive, and I looked out of the window of the car, and every place I saw dandelions going was a place that had a lot of car exhaust or where they spray the sides of the roads from trucks that are passing by. And the dandelions are trying to repair that. And they do the same thing in our body. It's a major detoxifying herb. And once we're detoxified, we don't need the dandelions anymore. And they'll just sort of quietly release their space to something that we appreciate more, right? But if you're an herbalist, really appreciate dandelions. But the sex disruptiveness, you find it in areas that are not very lush, or the soil isn't very good quality. And this is true of a lot of radiation herbs, that they like to grow in depleted soils or swamps or marshy areas, places where there's a lot of toxic runoff or savage things have happened. I'm intrigued because I did a meditation in Nevada when I was there. I just was heartbroken when I was there. I felt like the sand had been sterilized by all of the nuclear testing. And then as I started to adjust to this landscape, I saw these yucca trees. And there, I haven't seen any studies to prove this, but I'm hypothesizing based on the other studies that I've done that because they're very sort of sudsy, that because of the saponins, that moisture has helped them to survive the dryness that is caused by exposure to radioactive material. And every single tree was different. And they just didn't look even exactly like they belonged to the same family, like they could all be just a little unrelated. And I thought, they each made their own adaptive effort, and they survived. And the survivor in Japan was ginkgo, right at ground zero. There were
ginkgo
trees, this very tree that has been cultivated in Chinese and Japanese monasteries for thousands of years. It's one of the oldest trees on earth. It's actually referred to in botany books as a living fossil. And it has no relatives. It's a family all of its own, and very slow growing. Once it establishes itself, it lives for thousands of years. But right in Hiroshima itself, in ground zero, within, well, let's say a mile or so of the blast, there were four ginkgo trees that survived.
That's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is. It really is when you think of it, because nothing else survived. Buildings didn't survive. And as we remember from the shocking pictures that we saw, people just dematerialized. You know, we saw shadows of where they had been, but there was nothing else. And then as you went further out from ground zero, there were different levels of survival. But the fact that the ginkgo survived is utterly amazing. And so what happened, I guess, I don't know how people come to decide what they're going to try when they're faced with a survival issue, but the Chernobyl workers were given an extract of ginkgo to protect them while they were doing what they were called liquidators. It was very different how they organized in Chernobyl compared to Japan. There were 800,000 liquidators in Chernobyl, and they had very short shifts. They might have 45 seconds or, you know, 2 minutes at work, and then they were out of there. That was it. And in Japan, they're using just a handful of, so more than a handful, 300 workers, more or less, on suicide missions. Yeah, the odds of those people surviving are very, very low.
That's a cultural difference, you know, because I suspect they know they won't survive, and they're doing it on behalf of the collective.
I think that it's it's a sacrifice that they're making based partly on social pressure, probably, and partly on maybe their concern for others, but they know that the odds are against them. But we have been totally unsuccessful trying to send anything like ginkgo or any other radio protective herb to them. We just can't get it through the bureaucracy. We've tried so many different avenues.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That part I don't understand. That's the part I don't get.
Yeah, it's very hard to imagine the level of chaos. Chernobyl was one incident in an otherwise stable situation, but here you had a tsunami and an earthquake and thousands of people who died, and
there are
many
who
have been evacuated, and the whole societal infrastructure has been disrupted.
Yeah.
So
the proportion of the disruption is much greater in Japan than it was in Russia.
Yes, and there's a different approach to decision making. I'm not in a position to judge anything. I was in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, and one of my assignments was to go around to all the various government ministries to determine what the level of capacity was, could they function or not. And I wrote a report, so that one person showed up for work here and two people here. I went, Ministry of Finance, Central Bank, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, you know, all of these different government offices, and practically nobody was there, and they weren't working. Those who were there were just talking about, you know, what a horrible situation it was. We were all worried about family members that they hadn't been able to make contact with. And so you have a collapse of your capacity to function as a government.
Yes.
So But we don't have any idea of the magnitude of that collapse in Japan. Everyone's impacted because the winds didn't just move straight out to the sea. They went some very peculiar directions. Korea's been hit. And something's happening that there's blowback, and it's very
going to
difficult.
Be really overwhelming to the populace, period. And I've heard that some people are leaving and that sort of thing.
But where do you go? I mean, you could go to the southern hemisphere, perhaps, but the northern hemisphere's going to have to deal with this problem.
Right.
Of course, what we're seeing is this is one complex of reactors, and there are 400 or 500 other nuclear plants in the world. And
yeah, I think a lot of people are taking a second look at all of that too. I think we're going to see a lot of changes in this country. I don't know about other countries, but I think there are going to be a lot of changes in this country about preparing for more than we expected was possible, because that's what happened to the Japanese. They had prepared for what they thought was the maximum possible natural disaster, and they were surprised that something worse could happen. So
sure.
I think my take on it is that people are reexamining the whole idea of nuclear reactors, and, you know, are they on a fault line?
And that's the tip of the iceberg. The really stupid thing about nuclear power is that the plants have a life expectancy of 40 or 50 years, and after that, what do we do with the waste? And so against the backdrop of the age of the planet, this is really silly. And you take 4.5 billion years to get to where we are now, and that we're going to create this much of an environmental crisis in half a century simply because we want to create energy through splitting atoms. And it's
a learning curve for humanity. It's what it is.
Yeah,
and
I saw this. Sorry?
It's a learning curve, and I think the thing that gives me hope is that human knowledge is doubling at a very exponentially increasing rate, and it's every few months now is the way that I understand it. So I suspect we're going to have some technology very shortly that we didn't even think was possible. But I do totally feel like we're going to come up with new energy technologies that will allow us to retire those nuclear power plants and rue the day they were ever built.
Right.
It's clearly a mistake to me.
Right. I would tell a couple of stories out of school. I had a friend that worked at Los Alamos Labs. I used to live in Santa Fe, so I was there when there was the huge fire. And all the environmental people were trying to figure out how much nuclear material was stored. And all the initial government reports, so we're not involved in any kind of nuclear research at this point. But what? You know, who's supposed to believe this kind of press release? And it took them more than a month to organize their tours for journalists. And you were supposed to look straight ahead and not see things that you weren't supposed to see. But there were a few people whose cameras turned, and they found that a whole lot of the nuclear material was stored above ground in 55-gallon barrels or trenches, and none of it was being disposed of properly. And that amount was staggering. We're talking tens of thousands of barrels. And if you then start thinking, well, what's going to happen to all of this material. We're producing it on a staggering scale. What's going to happen, I think, for those people who are reactive to this disaster is not just that they'll be anti-nuclear, but that they're going to be pro-environment and realize that if we want to stay on this planet, we're going to have to harmonize with nature.
Yep. It's a wake-up call for sure. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to, before we run out of time, I want to summarize again for people what they can do to protect themselves, which is eat purple stuff and dark red stuff like beets. Should this be eaten in burdock? Should this be in ginkgo? Now, should these things be eaten raw? Say, is beet juice going to be, raw beet juice going to be more effective than, say, pickled beets or cooked beets?
From what I'm reading, the cooking did not cause a deterioration in the value. And there are not too many studies here. So I'm just combing through them one after another, and most of the ones that I've seen suggest that cooking's okay. And one of the most interesting realizations that I have in my life is that how well prepared I was to take a position here, because for the last 2 years I had been researching longevity therapies from India, and I got heavily involved in a rejuvenative program called Kaya Kalpa. And Kaya Kalpa, traditionally, not the popular version, but traditionally one went into darkness for 40 days and had a very specific diet of food and herbs, after which one appeared as 30, 35 years of age. So I found the formulas that were used. A colleague of mine found some that were used in recent times, and I found historic ones. And then I started studying each individual herb. So now when I go to the PubMed websites to see how they're conducting the radiation studies, I'm finding the same list of herbs that were in the rejuvenative tonics from India, including Ceylon Kush. So the research is, in fact, mostly being done in India. There are a few odds and ends of research from Japan, Korea, and Europe. But I would say 80 to 85% of the studies I've done, not only in India, but of herbs that are traditional in Ayurvedic and Siddha medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And these are cooked, and they're cooked and cooked and cooked. When you're making Ceylon Kush, the fruit itself, amla, a tropical gooseberry, is cooked over a brew of 35 herbs. The berries are actually in a muslin bag, but they're suspended in the liquid. And then after they're cooked, the seeds are removed. And then some more spices are added and minerals. And the minerals that are added are often toxic, like arsenic and mercury. And so I got very curious about how can they use these to regenerate. And I got heavily into Indian alchemy. And what they're doing with mercury, for example, is grinding it and heating it, and then mixing it with lemon juice, and then they're heating it again and mixing it with turmeric, and this goes on for years. There's stages and stages of process of purification. And what must be happening is that the mercury gives up its instability. That has to be the secret. That once it's surrendered its instability, it's no longer toxic.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I tried to find different ways to explain this to people who haven't had a jump start the way I have, and one of them was snake venom. I don't know if you've heard about a treatment where you just give yourself a shock or give the person who's been bitten a shock.
Like car
battery or a portable battery. A lot of people that are in the bush and are at very high risk of snake bites carry these, and it's just a way of shocking. The moment they've given themselves that shock, the venom ceases to be toxic.
Wow.
Yeah, so we have to re-examine
how much we don't
why
know.
Something is toxic to us.
Yeah.
Because it isn't. It's only toxic if our reaction to it is uncomfortable in some way.
Yeah.
If we accommodate it, it ceases to be a threat to us. And I'm afraid that many of us are going to find that we've got a very steep learning curve here. We're going to have to learn to get along with radioactivity. And we'll figure it out. We'll do it. In the meantime, what I'm doing personally, and I think this is, again, just sort of helping people to take their first step, is I am going to plant sunflower. And the seeds are still edible. I have birds. I have three parrots. And everything I've read is that you have to be very careful how you dispose of the roots and the stalk. But you don't want to compost them and then use them on your spinach, that's what I'm saying.
No. I guess not.
Right. Yeah, and so and we'll have to just allow the earth itself to reabsorb the chemicals. And then maybe there's some plant that is able to break down the stalks of the sunflower and a little more.
I'll bet you that it's a fungus.
Yeah, there are some bacteria and that we know for sure will work, and there are also, I'm sure, various kinds of fungi that are going to be useful. I happen to be very allergic to mold, not to use, but to mold, and so I'm not going to run those experiments. I'll leave that to Paul Stamets. But one of the most interesting plants for me right now is sea buckthorn. I planted it a couple of weeks ago. This is grown in the Himalayas. I think some of the sources come from Mongolia and Lithuania. And Israel, but it actually likes the cold, so I don't know where Israel is growing it. But it's first mentioned in Tibetan medical texts about 800 years ago, and it's a berry, beautiful, beautiful berry with orange fruit. It can be quite big, like 30 feet tall. And very, very sour, with a little bit of astringency. So that's what I learned in my studies with Chilean trash, is that the amla also has that sourness with the astringency, and it's the astringency that apparently gives it its stability. That, you know, most vitamin C is very unstable. And when you've got that astringency there, it binds it so that the Chilean trash actually has a shelf life of about 100 years. And
I need
so
to let you know that we've only got about 2 minutes left.
Okay.
So is there any particular thing you want to be sure people know? Why don't we tell them about your website?
Yeah, see buckthorn, because it's
sea
a
buckthorn.
Very...
Okay.
It's a very fine radioprotective herb. You're not going to get a harvest for a while. But the other side of that is nobody's going to get cancer tomorrow. You know, if this radioactivity predisposes people to developing cancer, it's going to be down the road, way down the road.
Right.
Except
and Pope, what about Phytolacca? What about Phytolacca americana? How about people plant some of that?
I haven't seen studies on that as much as I have on mayapple. There's a Himalayan mayapple that's way more toxic than the American one. It's an herb that has to be used extremely carefully. And, you know, we're all just at the very beginning here. And so I'm seeing that I'm pulling together a team of people. It's going to take us a year to get all of our information organized and presented. In the meantime, I just say subscribe to ZeroRads.com because we're going to be posting things as we're as our confidence level goes up.
Okay,
and
let's spell that for everybody. That's ZeroRad as in dog S.com. ZeroRads.com.
Right.
And if you want to learn more about what Ingrid's doing, you can go there and then follow the trail to many of her other websites where she has put out just tons of information that you really can't find anywhere else. She's, as you may have noticed, a really brilliant herbalist, and she has given very unselfishly of her time today, and I want to say thank you very much, Ingrid, for being with us today.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, I want to remind you that I have a free newsletter on my website, hotpinklotus.com, and you can sign up for it. I've been sending it out for about 12 years. Also, if you are in the area, in the Houston area, save the date, May 12th. I'm having a book signing of my book, Akashic Records, Case Studies of Past Lives, May 12th, 7 p.m. at Body, Mind, and Soul Bookstore. Body, Mind, and Soul. Thank you for being with us today, and come see us next week at 9 p.m. And I will be talking with Joan Walker, who channels the Ascended Master Kusumi and Archangel Gabriel. And she's always a very fascinating guest. So I do hope you'll join us next week. Have a blessed day, a blessed week, and a blessed life. Remember, focus on what you want, not on what you don't want.